You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Welcome to another episode of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the book to meet the authors and professionals in the publishing industry. We sent Jason away, and now he's returned to the cold, freezing land of Michigan. How you doing, Jason?
I am very, very cold. As you guys know, I spent a wonderful spring break with Katie's family and my wife, and it was just phenomenal out in Nevada. And now we're back to trying to survive the last of winter, but hopefully it's almost over. Yeah, but I'm here.
Blue skies and sunshine over here.
Yeah. Hey, we had blue skies, but it was only 49 degrees, so.
Too cold for my blood. And speaking of cold, one of our authors is from Colorado. Is that correct? We've got
both of us.
Both of you. Oh, perfect. So Natasha Wing and Stan Yan are both children's book authors and illustrators. Is that correct?
I'm an author.
I'm an author illustrator.
Author and author illustrator. Okay, so let's go ahead and throw one of them under the bus, and they can tell you a little bit about their work. Natasha, I'm going to give you the first go.
Okay. So I have been writing for 26 years, and most of my books are for kids that are 3 to 8 years old. So I write very young picture books. And I have a series that was based on The Night Before Christmas. And a lot of the books are either school-based or they're holiday-based. So this is sort of my meat and potatoes. And this is what keeps me in business and writing and having a salary. And the other things I like to do on the side are narrative nonfiction. So I did a book about Jackie O and how she saved Grand Central Terminal. And I'm also interested in artists. So Joseph Albers actually was a neighbor of mine when I was a kid growing up in Connecticut. So a lot of my books, I was trying to figure out an encompassing description of what I do. And I think silly to serious is probably a good description. And it gives me a lot of leeway so I can, you know, if I'm interested in a topic about a first lady, I can write about that. But then if I want to be silly and write about things like dancing bagels and cupcakes, then I can do that. So that's the scope of what I do. And I have about 32 books and 2 on the way. So I'm still very busy and active at doing this.
That's wonderful. Awesome. Wonderful.
Sorry, Jason.
No, I was just thinking about dancing bagels and cupcakes and how amazing it would be if they danced right into my office for me to eat right now. Because I love cupcakes. That's phenomenal. So you've got 32 books, you said, right?
32. A couple of them are out of print. Like, of course, my very first one is out of print that came out. And that's like, oh, man, when that happened, I was kind of sad. But most of them are in print, and I have 2 more Night Before books on the way, and then I forgot about, I've got 2 joke books, too. I actually had to come up with 1,200 jokes recently for 2 different books, so those will be coming out, I think, next year.
You have actually created jokes yourself?
Yes, but, you know, some jokes, you see them in slightly different forms, but I had to come up with 600 jokes about food and then 600 jokes about things that fly.
Okay, now give me an example.
No.
Give me an example about a joke about food. I want to hear this.
No, I knew you would ask that because I'm better at thinking them up than delivering them. Oh, gosh. Okay. Let me see. I've got pages of them here. I've got my manuscript. Like, okay, so here's my manuscript pages of all my joke books. And where's one? Oh, why was the apple put in jail?
Why?
Because he was rotten to the core. Nice. All right, so stuff like that. It's for very young kids.
I love it. It's like dad jokes.
Punny and funny jokes. I mean, that's my level of humor. I love puns, so it's like right up my alley.
My wife would absolutely love that book. She is so punny. It's ridiculous. And she was a band camp girl. She did band all through high school, and all my kids have done band. And so she'll show me all these weird punny band jokes about something to do with a saxophone, and I'm like, I've never been in band. I have no idea what this means.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the treble cleft. I don't know.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
Just got to smile and nod. That's all.
That's kind of what I do around here. Well, Stan, tell us about yourself, sir.
Well, unlike Natasha, my children's book career has been fairly recent. So this is actually my first, but I've been working for several decades on doing comic books and graphic novels, not for kids. And over the last almost 13 years, I've been probably better known for being the guy that draws you as a zombie at comic book conventions and things like that. So my foray into children's book was inspired by my son not wanting to come down to my basement studio that you see here. And his mom asks him, "What's wrong?" He says, "I'm scared." And she says, "What are you scared of?" And he started pointing at all of my zombie caricature artwork hanging from the walls. And instead of consoling him, I wrote this book instead.
to further terrify him, right?
Well, actually, the idea behind it is to, I wanted to comfort him. And in fact, as soon as he read the manuscript of the book, then he was actually no longer afraid of my artwork anymore. And he's actually started drawing and writing his own zombie books, which we've been selling at my booth at the Denver Comic Con over the past few years. So
he's
got his own fan following now too.
Now, do you have any of his artwork laying around there?
Not handily. like a horrible parent that I am, I don't have it with me.
Well, you have yours back there, and it looks very nice. And you brought up something that I was kind of chuckling with Katie about the other day when I was going through both of your websites and looking at stuff, and I was like, this Stan is going to be kind of interesting. He's got a children's book out. However, I'm seeing some very, very strange looking comic books for adults as well.
Yes.
So
I probably should have written one or the other under a pen name of some sort, right? Well, I don't know.
It cracked me up that they were all on the same website. Now, do you have a separate page or website just for your children's work as well that kind of kids and parents can go to?
Well, yeah, I have the separate page, or at least the URL for my book, which is theresazombieinthebasement.com, which someone pointed out to me, when you put theirs and an A together, it looks like Teresa's zombie.
Like, that sounds like a memorial by itself, so. Teresa the zombie.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I should have named her, because I've actually taken some of the characters, and some of my upcoming middle grade graphic novels feature some of these characters. So,
oh, that's very cool.
We have lives beyond this.
Now, I want to delve into that a little bit. The creation of a children's book is so much different than, say, an adult or even a young adult novel. You're usually dealing with more visual and less actual words. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, I think like most of my books have been really visually driven, and I don't have a lot of narration, so the pacing is really fast. I think the only book that I've written and illustrated that kind of diverges from this is a book that I'm currently almost done with. This is kind of a preliminary edition of it, which is a memoir graphic novel about my best friend's battle with cancer. And this one is extremely text heavy compared to what I typically write. I mean, one of the things that they always talk about in picture books or comic books and graphic novels is you want to do more showing than you want to do telling. And I've been pretty good about that for the most part. I mean, you've probably read some books where it seems a little redundant, where, you know, you read the text and the picture is kind of identical to what they're describing instead of adding something more to it. And so, you know, I think I've been pretty good about either doing some juxtapositions or, you know, at least eliminating a lot of the verbal redundancies.
Well, and you know, we had an author on, gosh, maybe a couple months ago now, or a month ago, and Katie, it was actually your sister, and she was talking to us about how interesting the illustrator's role in this is, and it's completely different than I had envisioned, where I had envisioned, okay, this page is talking about this, so you write a picture of that. Only she was saying that's really not how it is. Because like you just said, it's redundant. You know, you don't want a picture of Johnny reaching for the door. If you've just written Johnny reaching for the door, you know, they have to interpret it and kind of make it move forward for everyone. And I think that's a really cool thing and a really interesting part of writing for children versus writing just straight prose.
Now, dealing with child development or anything like that, I wonder if, like, there's two different camps, you know, where, especially for children that are maybe English as a second language, where saying that Johnny is reaching for the door and showing that is beneficial as far as learning a language or something like that. But I don't know.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add, there's other times when I'll write a book, like a night before book, and the illustrator will do the illustration and they'll say, can you eliminate these couple of lines because she's already done this and we don't need to show it again. So there's a point where I think the manuscript is done, but then when it goes to the illustrator, there's still a little bit of tweaking at the end.
So you're actually in communication with your illustrator?
Through my editor. So I don't,
okay.
Yes, I don't communicate directly, but my editor will come back and say, you know, Amy wants to do a double page spread here, and we think that these four lines will say enough on this page and we don't need this stanza. So, and I'll have to give the okay or whatever. So Amy and I don't contact each other directly, but there's a little bit of give and take during the process with the editor.
Okay.
That's going to be insanely frustrating because, you know, as an author, you've carefully chosen your words and you know what you're trying to say. And to have somebody come back and go, nope, we don't need that. We don't need that. I'm showing this over here. It's like, but I meant for this to be there.
Well, I know. And there has to be, you know, at the beginning of my career, I was so attached to my words. But I also, before I became an author, I worked in a public relations department of a newspaper. So we were writing the ads for the newspaper, and I worked with artists who were, again, putting words to my, pictures to my words. So I learned back then that it's a give and take process. And usually the artist is going to take what you've written and make it way better anyway. So there was a point where I just said, I've just got to give into the process, knowing that they're the experts and they'll make it better. And so I had to give up a lot of, fighting over particular words. When it comes to my night before books, I do fight a little bit more because of the beat and the rhythm and the rhyming and all that kind of stuff. When it feels off to me, I have to kind of argue with my editor a little bit about that. Doesn't just feel right to me. We got to put another beat back in there. So we do have a little bit more back and forth.
Okay. And now do you use the same illustrator for all of your books, or does your publisher choose who's going to be illustrating?
My publisher chooses, and I have many publishers too, but the Night Before books are with Grosset and Dunlap. And so, the series actually started off as one book and then it grew into a series. So it was more of an organic growth of the series versus a planned growth. And so partway through, we started just switching over to one illustrator. So the more recent books are Amy Wummer, one illustrator, but the other ones earlier were kind of mix and match. And then with the other, the other publishers, they choose the illustrator. And occasionally, like the bagel book, I did have some input and I was given things like character sketches of the bagel, and I was asked to rank the illustrators from 1 to 3, which one I liked the best. And then it turned out we both liked the same one. So that one worked out really good.
Oh, that's nice that at least there is a little bit of back and forth there on that. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Now you're obviously traditionally published, mm-hmm. And you said you have more than one publisher. How did you first get into this? What first brought you into the writing world?
Well, like I said, I was at a newspaper, and in Arizona, I worked for the Arizona Republic. Then I met my husband. We moved to California, and then I worked for an advertising agency. And it was a small market, and I was kind of doing boring things like ads for shoes for a local sporting good place or credit union ads and stuff like that. And so it was during the Nike days of Just Do It. And I was having that, you know, kind of a little meltdown going, this isn't creative enough. This isn't fun. And one of my girlfriends was like, well, what do you want to do? And it's like, I want to write children's books. And she's like, just do it. I'm like, yes, okay, I will. And then my, you know, my husband had a job, and I went to him. I said, what do you think about me taking a year off and just trying to see if it works? And he's like, well, if it doesn't work, just go back and get another job, but give it a year. So that's what gave me the, you know, kind of the support to go ahead and do it.
That's fantastic. And so in that year, did you write one book and start querying, or did you write a number of books to send out?
Well, I was super, super lucky. So what happened is I took a workshop at a local university, and I met other writers. And so I joined a writer's group. But then I also went to a SCBWI workshop, and I met other writers, and I felt like, you know, these are my people. They're very generous. They're not like competitive and not wanting to share any information about how to be successful. They were just really kind people. And it was at that conference where I met an author who was being published by Simon & Schuster. And so she said, well, here's my editor. She likes really simple stuff. You should send your stuff to her. So the first book I wrote, I sent to her, and she took it. And it's very unusual. Very unusual, but I just thought it was going to be so easy after that. I was like, oh God, this is great. Every book I write, they're just going to take. And I have files filled with books that people didn't take. So, you know, I learned my lesson along the way, but the very first one was thankfully went that way because it kept me in the game.
That's awesome. What a boost of confidence to be able to take and take forward with.
Yes.
I hear an echo.
Uh-oh. I hear an echo too. I'm going to mute me.
I think it's you. Uh-oh. Are you muted, Jason?
I think he's muted.
If it doesn't get rid of the echo, log out and log back in. See if that helps. And while we're doing that, let's turn it over to Stan. I want to hear your creation story. How do you go about creating your children's book? Do you lay it out like a storyboard? Because you are the author and the illustrator, so you don't have to worry about that back and forth. How does that work for you?
I mean, normally, I mean, a lot of different author illustrators work completely differently from one another. I mean, for me, I actually do all the writing and the text first, and then I go back and kind of match images and character and picture page illustrations with the different lines. So, you know, for me, I think the most important thing is in my book, there are certain times where, you know, I'm turning the pages and I want to make sure that the surprises are on the left facing page so you don't see it before you turn the page and things like that. So for me, you know, my book is also a rhyming book, and the meter is really important. But and a lot of people will say, oh, you've got to have each, you know, beat on each page be the same. And I thought, you know, I kind of broke them up a little bit sometimes just because the visuals themselves were a part of the meter as well. You know, whether or not it went along with how many beats per page on my writing. So, And that's kind of the way I'm approaching some of these middle grade graphic novels that I'm working on as well, is that I'm doing all of the text first, maybe with just like a few character designs to begin with. And I have to be honest, some of them are already done, but I because they're characters from there's a zombie in the basement, so they get a little life beyond this picture book, and I'm providing them with a little bit of extra depth as well, and then maybe a little redesign as well, just based on things that I want to do with them in the graphic novel that maybe the original designs weren't quite appropriate for them.
Now, when you're finished with a book, because you're indie and you're crowdfunding a lot of your books instead of going through the traditional market, do you have a group of beta readers that you pass it through before you go and hit that publish, or how do you finalize it and get it ready to put out to market?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I had the whole dummy drawn up, you know, with the three finished pages and then the rest of them just kind of black and white sketches. I made them into a dummy book that looked just like a real hardcover book. In fact, Selena Yoon of, you know, Penguin fame, she did the Illustrators Intensive at our local SEBWI conference the first year that I was a member of the organization. And so I took what she taught us, and I made this, you know, dummy book that looked like a real hardcover. And so while I was submitting my dummies to all these different publishers, I was taking this one of my hardcover dummies around to the different comic book conventions that I was drawing people as zombies at. And so while they were sitting there and I was drawing them, they could read my book. And so over the course of the next year, people were like, oh, how do I buy this? I'm like, it's not even finished yet. You know, it's just, you know, spray mount and cardstock and inkjet printouts. And I told them, well, you can sign up for my email list and I can let you know, you know, if a publisher picks it up, what the timeline is on this, or if I end up crowdfunding it. You know, I'll certainly let you know. And by the end of the year, I had populated my mailing list with 2,000 emails. And so that was kind of the basis of, you know, beside my social media, the people that ended up, I ended up marketing and my crowdfunding campaign to.
That's awesome. Now, when it comes to actually publishing it, what printer are you using?
Well, originally I was going to go to China, actually, because they were the only ones that were giving me a quote that I was really interested in. And then what ended up happening is once I launched my Kickstarter, you know, you get bombarded by all these people that promise to make your Kickstarter successful because of this service or that service or whatever they're going to provide you. But one of the organizations that was kind of trolling around the children's book projects was a company out of Virginia called Mascot Books. And so they contacted me and offered to give me a quote. I'm like, yeah, sure thing, you know. And they ended up actually coming in on a 1,000 book print run, only $400 more than the printer that I was going to go with. Plus, they were going to print in the U.S., and they were providing me with all sorts of marketing support. Like, they're going to, you know, write up a business plan for me, write a press release for me, basically get my book into Ingram, which was the most important aspect of it, since they kind of act as a publisher for self-publishers. And at that point, it was basically, you know, sold. I'll go with you guys instead. And the only thing that I was a little worried about is, you know, they didn't have an ability to send me a physical proof, which, you know, through the other printers, it was extremely expensive just for the proof itself. But so all I had to see was the PDF. And then, you know, when, you know, 500 of the 1,000 books showed up on my doorstep, that was the first time I actually got to see what the book looked like. And they actually exceeded my expectations. I modeled my book after Lemony Snicket's The Dark. And so all the specs for the paper and the cover and the finish was based on that. And so I was kind of expecting a book that was a little desaturated because of the uncoated paper. But the last page of my book has a page that says, you know, what are you scared of? draw a picture of it here. And I didn't want kids trying to draw with a crayon on some glossy magazine style paper, getting all frustrated like my son does at restaurants where that's what they give him for an activity page, and then they give him crayons and then wonder why the kids can't draw on these. And but you know, I honestly think that they did a better job of printing my book than whoever printed The Dark. So the colors were real vibrant and all the watercolor textures really popped and came through, so I couldn't have been happier.
That's awesome. I ask because there's so many different avenues for indie authors to go and produce their books. Some people go through author service type channels. Some go directly with Ingram. I know Ingram Spark is the self-publisher's arm of the right. primary company. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. And especially when you have a color book, and most children's books, you know, heavily illustrated, all kinds of colors, they tend to be the hardest to get out there.
Right. I mean, the one thing that forced me to crowdfund was that, you know, they're not print on demand like a lot of these other services. So, you know, to get my book to a cover price that was competitive, I had to print 1,000 copies, you know. And I'm happy to say that, you know, it sold fast enough that I got to my second printing pretty fast.
That's awesome. Jason, we can't hear you.
Oh, is he still on mute?
He's on mute.
He must still be on mute.
Poor guy. All right, well, let me flip it back over to Natasha, too, because I want to see, you told us a little bit how you got it started in writing children's books, but how do you actually start writing a children's book? What's your process for that?
Okay, so ideas come easily. And so it's no problem for an idea to pop in my head. Either, you know, it's talking to a friend whose their child has done something silly, and I'm like, oh, that could make a nice book. Or, you know, reading something in the newspaper or hearing something on the news going, huh, I wonder if that could make a book. So the ideas are just like pop, sizzle, popcorn all over the place. And then the next stage for me is to just, you know, go and write a quick draft, like how I think it's going to go, which way I think the story might lead. A lot of times I have visuals in my head, almost like, okay, here's a little movie that's dancing along. How can I capture it in text? And so I'll start writing little pieces and together. If I get to the middle and it feels like it's not going anywhere, or I get bored with it, sometimes I'll just put it aside. But for the most part, the ideas just keep flowing. And but what, you know, after I do that first draft, then another step that I might take, like I'm working on another narrative nonfiction right now, and I was having trouble coming up with a theme or trying to figure out how long it's going to be. Typical picture books are 32 pages, but since it's a nonfiction, I was thinking I'd either go 40 or 48 pages. So I wanted to do a storyboard, and you're not going to be able to read my little chicken scratch, but I took, you know, pieces of plain paper, and I tried to figure out, okay, what scene is going to happen here? And then like Stan, like, where's the page turner? Where's the excitement? And then when you turn the page, it answers either the question or it is the next dramatic moment. So this actually helped me solidify what I needed to say in the text and get rid of the other stuff that was either boring, like maybe people are just thinking, but there's no action. So the next stage for me after I write out the text of the nonfiction is what I'm going to do is print it out, cut up the different segments, and then tape it in here to see, again, to go through and then see where the turns are. If I have too much text on one page, maybe I need to edit out a little bit more. Or where can I put double page spreads that I can then, you know, make a note to the illustrator, okay, this is a double page because it's the climax of the story, what have you. So this, I keep forgetting about this when I write fiction, but I brought this back for nonfiction. Like, I should do this every time because it really helps shorten the process of self-editing.
Okay. Now, someone is chatting with us over the YouTube link, mm-hmm. and it's Go Indie Now. He said it's interesting how this part of the industry has standards like page count, and as many children's books authors and illustrators as they have talked to, none of them like to follow those rules. Now, how strict are these rules with your publisher? Are they giving you a come up with this page count for this story? Is that kind of how it works, or?
Yes, I mean you try to write so that it'll fit into 32 pages because that's the typical size and that's a easy price point. If you go up to 40 pages, you always go up by 8 pages. If you go up to 40 or 48, then the book gets more expensive, and now you've got an $18 or $19 hardback when you could have had a $15 or $16 one. So you try to write for the shorter 32 page. Again, with the narrative nonfiction, a lot of times what they'll do is say, keep the story part short, but there's a couple of pages at the end where you can expand in the end notes on your topic. So that's what I'm aiming for with this book. And what's happening now in picture books is what they're looking for is under 500 words, which is super short. But hopefully, narrative nonfiction, it's like under 1,200 or under 1,000 words. So that's what I'm shooting for that, and that'll keep it in the right page numbers.
Sorry, Jason, I keep interrupting you. Do you have, because you're writing for the younger age group, but obviously it's the parents who are probably reading to the kids. Mm-hmm. Do you have certain word lists that you kind of keep in mind to avoid or to use to keep it, I guess, easy for the little ones to comprehend?
No, and I've never liked those. I never liked word lists or, there's tools you can run it through to decide if this is, grade 2.2 or if it's grade 3 vocabulary. I've never liked that. I didn't want to be confined to it. What I try to do is see if there's a more simple word for this bigger word that I'm thinking in my head while I'm writing, and then try not to use that word too often, because a lot of times in picture books you're describing something over and over again, especially when it is when it is nonfiction, you're trying to get a concept across, or one is about historic preservation, and that's a big topic. So I had to think of all these different ways to describe historic preservation for a younger child. So I do not like the vocabulary list, and partly too because it gives the kids a chance to learn through context. So whether they're learning what that word might mean through my text, or since it is a picture book with illustrations, they might see what it is in the illustration and then make the connection.
And I love that learning through context. My youngest child is actually in Spanish immersion, and she has been there for 3 years now. And that first year is always, it's always really strange, because everything they're learning, it's not through this is what this word means, this is what this word means. It's all contextual. It's all the teacher speaks to them in Spanish and does some visual explaining, but otherwise it's all them picking it up out of context. And it's incredible how well that works, how our minds connect things to make that happen. So I think that's really cool. And it's funny, Katie's question was almost identical to what I was going to ask. But I was going to ask if you had any history in early child development or in teaching children in your past that you use to draw on to kind of create these stories.
Well, the only teaching I have is between books, because I got a little nervous. My first book was like, yay, this is so easy, it's coming out. And then my second book came out, Jalapeno Bagels, and I thought, okay, this is great. I've got something rolling here. And then there was like a 3-year break where nothing was selling. And I was like, oh man, I might be a 2-book wonder, and what am I going to do? I still need money, and I didn't want to go back to my other job. And so what I did is I ended up working as a reading tutor at an elementary school. And it was really valuable because it was, again, trying to figure out how do I translate language to kids who were having a hard time reading and helping them, you know, have that light bulb go off and go, oh, I know what this sound is and I know what this word is. And then seeing them put it all together, it was really exciting for me. So I did a little bit of tutoring, but unfortunately my tutoring job was also combined with lunch monitor and recess monitor. So it was crazy because the same kids I was tutoring, I was probably putting against the wall out at recess. So it was an odd kind of dynamic. And but luckily during that time is when I sold my first Night Before book, Night Before Easter. So I looked at how much I got for an advance versus how much I was making as a reading tutor. And I said, it's better off that I just write books.
Now, okay. Advances are a topic that have come up anytime we talk to traditionally published authors. And from the most part, we're hearing that advances are kind of going away. Are you seeing that in the children's book market?
Not yet, thankfully, because sometimes that's all you make if the story doesn't or the book doesn't take off. So, you know, my range and my big complaint is that my range of advances hasn't gone up over the 26 years that I've been writing. So my range is like from 2,500 to 5,500 for a book in advance. So if you think about that, I mean, that might be all you get for the year if this is the only book that you sell. Thankfully, I have royalties from past books, but I can't live off of $5,500 a year. So I've had to create a salary over, you know, trying to keep every other book in print and then getting royalties.
And how are you making sure your books sell? What do you do to help those sell? Is that all on the publisher's heads, or are you out there actively, you know, doing readings in schools or promoting or what do you do?
Yes. Well, you know, you have your website and you have your author Facebook page, so you can keep some interaction going with your fans. I do school visits. I attend conferences. I do Skypes, which I really love, like, you know, just sitting down like now in my office and just Skyping to schools all over the country. They don't make a lot of money, but I do sell my books to the schools so I can, you know, I send them signed copies. I make a little bit of money. Thankfully, the Night Before books kind of feed off of each other. So if a new one comes out and someone says, oh, I want to buy that one. And then they go, oh, look, she has 25 other ones. And, you know, I want that one too. And I want that one. So that thankfully is, they, like I said, it kind of feeds off of each other. And, how else? Well, occasionally, I'll show you an example. An Eye for Color was actually translated into Chinese. So once in a while, you'll get rights for your books to be translated into other languages. My Night Before books are also in Scholastic book clubs. And so Scholastic book clubs have been kind of keeping me in business too, because, you know, there's kids will buy them and they're very affordable. So
that
you'll
was gonna be my next question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just see so. That you said Scholastic, and you know, I have a kindergartner who gets the regular classroom Scholastic, you know, every month, and I've seen your books in there.
Yes,
yeah, I remember.
Very, very good to me, and I appreciate it too, because they also are really good about, okay, this is dental month, so we want books about the tooth fairy, and so I have one, or you know, this is Mother's Day month or whatever. So I have one of those books. So my books kind of plug into their themes too.
Now that actually works with a question that one of our viewers just posted. And this can go for you and Stan as well, because Stan, you have more creative control being indie. So he says, how important is making sure there's a message at the end of every story or a theme? And does your publisher push you towards certain subjects or suggest certain topics to write a story about?
Well, my publisher is a jerk, just to be honest with you. No.
Yeah, so is his boss.
Right. So, I mean, for me, you know, whatever inspires me, I just found that the books that I'm writing have had messages in them. Whether I kind of set out to make them have messages or not wasn't really the case. I mean, when I write my stories, I kind of create my characters first and give them backstories and then just kind of plug them into scenarios and interactions and then, you know, give them a conflict and, you know, it makes it a lot easier to write for them. And sometimes they just kind of write themselves. So the book that I've written that I hope to submit to an agent here before too long is, you know, the book that features the characters from There's a Zombie in the Basement actually has a, you know, a message. By the time I finish it, I'm like, you know, this really is not a very a veiled message or theme of racial harmony, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I went into it trying to make that the main message. I know that was kind of one of the themes that I was exploring, but that became, you know, a really big theme in it. And I think it's pretty timely at this point in our history. So I'm pretty proud of it.
Sometimes you find the theme after you've written it. Like, you don't realize you're writing about a theme until it's done and you can see that broad picture.
Right. No, we just had another question come in from Brian, who's a friend of ours. He's been on our show, and he said, with the difficulties of the industry and how it's all been changing lately, how do you keep yourself motivated to continue writing? And this is something that is not new to us on the show. This is something that a lot of writers struggle with. A lot of indie writers, especially, there has been a real downturn for a lot of us in sales. I think over the last 5 years or so, I know for myself in particular, I had a really great year, you know, 5-6 years ago, and then ever since then, it's slowly getting less and less and less. And in my head, I was always thinking it's because as more authors come online and as more books are added to Amazon, that it's harder to stand out. You know, it's harder to be seen, and so and also there's a lot more competition out there. But very recently, Amazon's been changing all sorts of stuff about the way they market and how they approach indie authors versus traditionally published authors. And I don't think, Natasha, I don't think that has as much of an effect on you, probably, you know, working with larger publishers. But have you seen any changes in the industry that have affected how sales work for you?
Well, when there was that time when independent bookstores were being threatened by Amazon, you know, that was a big concern because, you know, the indies are the ones that do all the hand selling. And I don't know, I was kind of nervous about what's going to happen then. But then, you know, Amazon also is the biggest bookstore and they've got the distribution and marketing all figured out. So you really do want to work with them. And they have a program that I tap into called the, I think it's called Amazon Affiliate, where I can monetize books by, you know, like maybe my friend had a book come out and then I have a little code in my thing that links you to Amazon and I get a kickback from them. So there's ways that you can make money off of other people's books too, but I don't make that much. I don't know the way, I've only seen downticks and maybe the obviously the ones that have gone out of print. You wondered why, you know, the topic was still valid, but it's like, why did that book go out of print, but the other ones in the series didn't? So I don't know. Sometimes it's about the packaging. Sometimes it's like, you know, should it have been a board book instead of a paperback picture book? And so maybe by repackaging you can find a new audience. So you have to be really flexible in trying to figure out a new way to present it to a new audience.
Okay. Now, what about you, Stan? Because you're still an indie author right now. I know you said that you're hoping to submit to some agents soon. But it sounds like you sell a lot of physical copies at conventions and things like that.
Right. I have to be honest, my sales on Amazon has been miserable, and I probably approached it the wrong way, but, you know, it's a learning experience. And, you know, I think going forward, if I have to, you know, self-publish any of my stuff or, you know, I'll continue to do my own marketing, whether or not, you know, I have a publisher or not, but, you know, they'll let me kind of line things up a little bit better just so that, you know, I've got more pre-sales and, you know, I've got a bigger launch as well. But, you know, yeah, for me, you know, my experience marketing my comic books has always been kind of guerrilla marketing anyway, and going to events, selling them directly to my fans. And, you know, I've never sold a ton of stuff online. And so, you know, that's really all I've known. But, you know, ever since I joined the SEBWI a few years ago, it's been an eye opener, and it's actually been heartening because I feel like I've been beating my head against a market that is working really hard to keep out small press and other independent authors, and there's actually a roadmap into children's books that I kind of chuckle to myself when I hear people talk about how difficult it is to get in. I'm like, well, you haven't been trying to get into comic books for the last 20 years. And I think that, you know, with my son being my inspiration for my work, it's been kind of a confluence of things. I mean, I've had relatives that have been bugging me to get into children's books for decades. You know, it's just too time consuming, especially when you're doing the illustration too. You're writing and illustrating your books. You really have to be passionate about what you're doing to dedicate that much time to it. So I think, you know, just the confluence of life events for me have gotten me into children's book just at the right time. And so for me, you know, I'm not feeling any of the downturn just because I don't. This is my first children's book, so I don't know how things would have been if I had a children's book prior to this. So I guess that's kind of good, you know, how they say ignorance is bliss, right?
Absolutely.
and Katie, I know this is not a new subject for you as well, you know, talking about Brian's question and how do you stay motivated even when sales seem crappy or there's a lot of negativity out there. What do you do to keep going? Because you've got 20 novels now. Is that about right?
Something like that. You know, for me, it's a lot of just head down and keep writing. You know, I use that hashtag a lot on Facebook, just keep writing. And that's pretty much what it is. You know, I try and just throw myself into writing and get the next book out and the next book out. And yes, I do the marketing and it's draining and looking up reports and all that stuff. It gets very tedious. So I try to focus less on looking at the numbers and more on just producing more material. And I think that helps.
Yeah, you know, and again, it seems like I keep bringing this up over and over. And I know that we're gonna go back to that question from Go Indie now because they wanted Natasha to answer a question too. But, you know, back to that very first episode of this show, when you guys asked me what my plan was and said, my plan is to not have a plan. I'll tell you what, I was so much happier then because I was just like, it's all just whatever. I've got words out there. There's a book floating around on Amazon and hey, maybe it sells. And now that I actually track the numbers and really try hard to sell things, I'm like, crap, this is hard. And it gets you down if you're looking at your numbers and you're like, oh, man, I sold two books last week. What happened to selling 200 in a week, you know?
So and what worked last week doesn't work this week. And what your neighbor does doesn't work for you. And there's no one size fits all when it comes to marketing.
To answer your question, Brian, man, I think Katie has the right idea. Just put your head down and keep writing and just try to tunnel vision through all that negativity. And of course that's way easier said than done. But honestly, I think that as an independent author, that's all we can do is just keep focusing on making our words the best words that we can possibly make and hopefully make a story that, you know what, if this year one person reads this book that absolutely falls in love with it, and Jason Lavelle becomes their favorite person, I'll be freaking happy. It doesn't matter that I made 30 cents. I will be very happy if someone falls in love with my words. That's what I want. So, okay, Katie, can you go back to a Go Indie Now's question? Because we want to get an answer from Natasha.
That's right. We're back to the theme topic. So, Natasha, you said you work multiple publishers. Do they suggest certain topics or themes that they want you to write about?
Nobody except for Grosset and Dunlop with the Night Before series. And it's gotten to a point where I can work with my editor and just throw out an idea. And a lot of times the ideas actually come from like Amazon fans, or if I go visit a school, the teacher will say, we are so in desperate need of a Night Before Groundhog's Day book. Can you write one? And I'll say, well, let me see. I'll ask my editor. And what she'll do, though, instead of just saying yes or no, she's got to take it to a marketing meeting where they have to determine if this topic is something that will sell in the mass market, because, you know, my Night Before books are all mass market. They're not truly library market. So they have to run it through their little numbers to see if it's going to be viable. And then if they come back and say, yes, why don't you go ahead and write that? Then I write my story. So I'm very fortunate in that regards. But other publishers will meet with my agent, and the agent will come back and say, here's what they're looking for. They're looking for fun books about boys, or they have way too many books about the ocean. Now we could use books about the desert. So do you have any? And if I have it, then I'll try to fix it up and send it out. If I don't have it, occasionally I'll try to write it. But I've found that it's really hard for me to write to a specific need of a publisher, because they'll go back and forth and back and forth. And a lot of times they don't take it in the end anyway. And then you're stuck with a manuscript that you can't sell anywhere else. So I've come up against that a couple times. I don't know if that answers your question. No, but
that's an excellent answer.
Yeah.
Also, you know, it kind of works with, you know, writing what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. You can put more love into a story that you really connect with, mm-hmm, than you can with something you're assigned to write.
Yes. And that's what I was feeling last year, because I there was like two or three examples where I was like frantically trying to write to this need. And I could feel myself sitting in the chair just going, oh, you know, just kind of pushing it out, and it wasn't working. And then I'd force it, and then I'd hand it in, and they'd be like, oh, it doesn't feel right. And they probably felt that I didn't have the passion. And in the end, I'm like, I just wasted 3 months or whatever when I could have been writing something I really cared about. But, you know, there's sometimes you feel like you have to chase the dollars and the opportunities while they're there. And other times you look at friends, you know, who have won, you know, the Prince Award or the Newbery Award, and they just said, I just wrote what I loved, and it took me 3 years, and now I'm getting the reward. You know, so well, which one works? You know,
that's the whole toss up between, I guess it's no toss up at all sometimes, but between writing with your passion or writing to market. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing we've talked about a couple times. You know, the whole write to market movement is trying to write that novel for exactly what's hot at exactly that minute and get it out while it's still hot. And yeah. I wish that I could do that. And in fact, my publisher, I work with a small press publisher, has said that we only want this specific type of books from you. So I can only write that specific kind of books for this publisher,
right.
which is frustrating, because I want to write other things as well. But mm-hmm, you know, the whole chasing the dollar sign, it, as you said, while I need money to pay my mortgage,
yes,
it's so much more difficult, I think, because you're putting yourself in a box. And I don't like being nobody puts Jason in a box, okay? I don't want to be in a box.
You know, and I think that is one of the big questions between authors too. It's like, do you become that niche author who is really good at one topic, and then other publishers go and seek you out because you write that kind of story? Or do you write, like, try not to be in the box, and then they don't know what to do with you? Like, I had an agent was like, you love to write fairy tales, and you like concept books and picture books, and you're trying to do a chapter book. And it's like, because that's why I'm in a creative field. I want the freedom to explore whatever I'm interested in. But then when it came to market me, they didn't know what to do. So it's like, can you just decide and then pick something and stick with it for a while and then get something published. And then if you become really popular, then you could say, oh, well, I just want to try something new because I can. And I was like, no, I need the freedom to explore whatever topic I'm interested in. And if you don't want to buy it, we'll just keep moving on.
You know? So that strength right there. That's awesome.
That is fantastic. I love that. It's great. Yeah. My publisher told me I had fractured my reader base by writing in too many different directions. I'm like, yeah. I probably did. I'm not going to stop doing it, but
that's kind of my problem too. I mean, I've got dystopian, I've got young adult, I've got adult, and you know, the unifying factor in all my books is the paranormal theme. There's mm-hmm. always supernatural creatures that I write about, but I write what I want to write. I write what I'm passionate about writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, at one point I asked my past agent if I could just use a pen name. I think Stan was talking about that too. It's like, I should have used a pen name for my other genre. But, you know, then she was like, well, but then what if they find out who you are? And then they say, well, you're the one that writes all those Night Before books. And now you're writing about, you know, squids or something. It's like, I don't know. Hopefully they can accept it, because you don't expect every Hollywood director to just stick with one type of movie. So why can't I try different genres too? So it was a big discussion.
Well, and you never know which creative project is going to be that one. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many great authors throughout history that are very well known for one piece of work that was just absolutely incredible. Yeah. And you never know which one that's going to be. So why not spread yourself out and try all these different things? Because, you know, someone may see that passion project and say, wow, this is incredible. This is it. Mm-hmm. And that could be one of your big moments. So I think that's what I'm still hoping for. I'm still hoping to find that project that is just speaks to me and speaks to everyone else, and that they really, really can fall in love with.
Yeah. And I'm just hoping I retire on that high note instead of the book that goes out of print in a year. You know? I'm hoping I can say, well, thanks everybody that, you know, you're allowing me to retire. I'm going to buy a house in the Caribbean. You know? But so that's my dream.
That's awesome.
Well, we're getting close to time, but I have one more question. I want to direct it at Stan first, since you said you are starting to approach agents with your work. And I know, Natasha, you've already got an agent. Mm-hmm. How does someone who writes in the young adult or middle grade age group approach an agent or approach a publisher with their work? Is it the same process as you would with a traditional novel?
That's a big, good question. You know, I'm kind of going into this cold, so this is my first attempt. I mean, I did submit There's a Zombie in the Basement to agents and publishers before, but I'm going to be honest with you, that was kind of a passion project where I wasn't going to be willing to, you know, let anyone change anything too much, whereas these upcoming projects, you know, I've written something I'm proud of, but I'm definitely much more open to input. And you know, I think the most difficult thing right now isn't necessarily the market. I've done a little bit of research and gone to some of these Rocky Mountain chapter SEBWI Connects, Creative Connects, where we actually talked about writing to particular audiences and how the stakes for your protagonist are different. The support systems or the adult support systems are different as well. So I made sure to include those in how I'm writing these scripts as well. But I think for me right now, the biggest obstacle is that a lot of the trade publishers that I would like to eventually approach, even though they've all published graphic novels at this point, it's hard to actually find, whether you're talking about an agent or a publisher, a submission guidelines. You know, if I follow the picture book submission guidelines, do I have to draw all 164 pages of my graphic novel? you know, if it doesn't go anywhere, it's like a horrible investment of my time. but then on the flip side, if I submit it like a novel submission, are they going to lose the aspect of my illustration talents, you know, because that's a part of what I'm selling. And as a writer illustrator, I've been told time and time again, that's an asset for me at this point in time where a lot of publishers want a writer illustrator that, you know, there's no intermediary between, you know, the person who came up with the idea and the actual illustrations that hit the page, you know. So I don't know. We'll find out.
I assume that would be less work for the publisher too, if
I would think
two or one. Now I have a strange question for you. Where do you feel like you're stronger in the writing or the illustrating, or is it kind of an equal amount of both?
Well, I mean, if you were to look at how much money I'm making off of either independently, then probably my illustration. But I've always considered myself primarily a writer and only secondarily an illustrator. And you know, more than once people have asked me, well, if you could only do one, write or illustrate, but not both for a living, which would it be? And without hesitation, write for sure.
Okay.
Because I'm more of an idea guy, you know. That's why, you know, a lot of people feel like, oh, I'd love to, you know, get involved in animation. But to me, that's just like tedium. You know, if I was going to get involved in animation, I would want to be, you know, the storyboard artist or the character designer or something like that. I don't want to be the guy that makes the hair blow on Sully's back or something like that, you know. So
I can't imagine the people that do that. That is
good at it.
I don't think I could deal with.
Well, and those storyboard artists, I mean, I know it's a part of the process that we rarely see when we see a finished product, when we see a finished book or a graphic novel or movie even. But sometimes when you get the extra features or you get the inside look, those storyboard artwork is one of the coolest parts. It's oh, yeah. Awesome. It's really cool how that works.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. It's always disappointing when I buy a DVD of an animated feature and it doesn't barely have anything on the extras, because that's kind of why I want to buy it. You know, I want to see the storyboard art. I want to see some of the concepts, some of the, you know, failed ideas and the outtakes, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, guys, we are at the end of our hour. I'd like you to each, if you wouldn't mind, kind of tell us a little bit about your most recent release, and that way we can give a shout out to that to all the viewers. Natasha, you want to go first?
Sure. So my most recent release was Bagel in Love, and it's a pun book. So there's a lot of puns in there about baked goods. And that was the one, and Stan has seen me at all the conferences. I actually, as one of my marketing things, I had a dress made that was inspired by the characters. And so I wear that to schools and stuff. But so I just love the artwork. And again, it inspired me. And then the other two things that are coming out are the joke books. So that's the upcoming ones.
Awesome. Awesome. I look forward to that. Oh, did you see that my wife, she must have been listening upstairs, had responded to what advice do you give to a musician crossing the street? C sharp or B flat?
Oh. Okay.
And jokes.
That.
What about you, Stan? Can you give us a brief plug on your There's a Zombie in the Basement?
Yes. There's a Zombie in the Basement is what I envisioned as a book that if Tim Burton and Dr. Seuss got together to write a book, this is what it would be. And you can find it at theresazombieinthebasement.com or teresazombieinthebasement.com, depending on, you know, how you see the words all mashed together there. There's other fun things like t-shirts, and I've got like little dolls. I've got a few of these left over
Did you crochet those dolls?
I did not. I was exhibiting at an anime convention next to someone that did all these little cute crocheted things, and she kept commissioning My Little Pony characters from me. And so I was like, there's something I got to be able to do for her. And I'm like, oh, you know what? There is something. Because I was, you know, I was already at the point where I had decided to do the Kickstarter. So I commissioned her. I gave her this artwork and had her commissioned her to do a prototype before I decided, you know, whether or not I was going to have her do a bunch of them for me.
And is that Teresa?
No. No. But and she came back with even the little heart that's floating on top of her head. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that is so cute. And unfortunately, you know, it, like any craft, it takes way more time than the you know, the amount that you could make off of it. And so she's like, oh, I can only make two of these a week, you know, because she works full time. And so she's not able to make anymore. So, you know, these are the last of them here. So there's a few of them left.
But those are very cool. I would love to have one of those for my little bookshelf right over there. She would sit just perfect on that.
Yeah, I see that. Maybe on top of the skulls that are right behind you.
That's right. But it's all got to be creepy in here. Awesome. Well, it's been a great chat with you guys tonight. We really appreciate you coming on with us and spending some time with us and our listeners. We have recently turned the show into a podcast as well on Podbean. It's on iTunes and it's on Stitcher. So if any of you out there like to listen to podcasts instead of watching videos on YouTube, it'll be up and available probably in an hour or two, and you can listen to our great conversation with these two guys.
Although they're going to miss out on all the great action that we're doing.
That's true. You won't be able to see the artwork. So I always recommend the YouTube version, but the podcast is cool too. Well, Katie, you want to roll us out?
Absolutely. Thank you guys, both Stan and Natasha. You guys were wonderful. And we're very happy to have you this week. You shared a lot of amazing insights with us. And I think our viewers, especially the ones who didn't get to make it to watch the show live, they're going to come back and they're going to pull a lot of insights from this. So thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
And for our viewers out there, we will be back next week with more authors to introduce you to. Please feel free to like and share and hit that subscribe button so you get notifications when our next shows go out. We'll talk to you then. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.